Shortly before the Buddha experienced Mahaparinibbana, we can read in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta that Venerable Ananda expressed some concern. It's actually interesting to see the Buddha not just as a supreme expositor or person explaining the Dhamma, the supreme ability of teaching the Dhamma, but also from the aspect of vinaya and management and administration and setting up the longest continuously existing organization on earth, namely the Sangha, ordained Sangha. It's quite amazing, requires exceptional ability. We talked about the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. It's not easy to get the Dhammacakka rolling, and only a Buddha can actually do that, setting that rolling. But also only a Buddha can establish an organization so successfully as he did with the Sangha. And you can see that in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta now, he is still tying up loose ends and addressing administrative question as a supreme leader and manager of the Sangha until the very last moment, until he goes into jhana, until his last instruction. Anibhikavi amantayami vo. Vayadama sankhara appamadena sampadita. Now, monks, I encourage you, all formations of a nature to decay, to vanish, to end, accomplish diligently, practice diligently. After that, he was finally free to go through the jhanas, his way of saying goodbye to samsara and then experiencing Mahaparinibbana. But before, they're constantly administrating, managing, doing things. You can see that nowadays with abbots also a little bit. I remember visiting Wat Mabjan and Ajahn Ananda being incredibly busy and managing things. And one of the issues Venerable Ananda brought up was, as long as the Buddha was alive, after the Vasa, so many monks would come and pay respects to the Buddha. Now, typically in the Katina month, the monks are still somewhat stationary until the Katina ceremony usually, because they spend Vasa and they're not yet traveling, but the Vasa is over, and so many monks would go to pay respects to the Buddha. And that is even the very eremitical, ascetic monks who usually hide out in the forest, but often of great qualities, like Venerable Mahakasapa, the very outstanding monks. But they would be attracted and they would pay respects to the Buddha. And Venerable Ananda, who was quite closely involved, much more so than other great monks, like Venerable Mahakasapa, who was an ascetic forest dweller, or like Venerable Anuruddha, who was very good to recognize the intention of the devas, but who had no real interest or skills in human admin affairs. But Venerable Ananda, as the attendant of the Buddha, had obviously a strong involvement with that. It's not just attendant, it's basically a secretary, assistant. And he realized this was such a great opportunity for junior monks and for many monks, any monk at all, to have contact with these outstanding monks who come to pay respects to the Buddha. And it would draw in all these great monks. And then also all the other monks get a chance not only to see the Buddha, who would be somewhat limited in the personal interaction. So many, he can't give personal instruction to all of them, he's getting older. But all the other outstanding monks are also there for that reason. And that gives a chance to interact for the others. And then the Buddha instituted, recommended the practice of going on pilgrimage. Now that is one way how the Buddha responded to that. And you can actually see that nowadays, if you were to spend one full pilgrimage season in Bodh Gaya, you tend to meet very many, very outstanding monks, also outstanding lay people, and often at the kind of peak experience in spiritual terms. And I remember having met Ajahn Anand, Ajahn Wanchai. I've never met Ajahn Wanchai in any other occasion, even in this relatively short period. Of course, and nowadays we don't have a Buddha anymore. But you may be aware that I'll be traveling to Amaravati this coming Thursday, and the occasion is the 90th birthday of Lumpur Somedo. It's actually not his real 90th birthday. His real 90th birthday is end of July, but that falls into the rainy season retreat, the Vassa, and would be very inconvenient for the Sangha trying to gather at that time. So they decided to do it together with their Vesak celebration in Amaravati. So we're going there for an Acharya Puja, celebrating and paying respects to Lumpur Somedo on occasion of his 90th birthday. You're probably aware that he is the most senior Western disciple of Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had very unusual power in attracting and being able to teach and train the foreigners. Probably of all the disciples of Ajahn Mun, taking them all together, Ajahn Chah on his own has probably more Western disciples than all the other great disciples of Ajahn Mun together. And this was very outstanding, and Lumpur Somedo was the first one. It's one of these famous stories that apparently once when they were building kutis in Wat Nong Papong, that was before any Farang, any Westerner had turned up there, Ajahn Chah told them to build them a little bit bigger. And the villagers inquired, and apparently he said something, yeah, we never know, and the foreigners, for example, are much taller than we are. Whatever. I mean, I haven't verified that story, there's kind of stories floating around, but I like that, and I could imagine that he had some intuition. Certainly Lumpur Somedo was very tall, a real tall American, and he was the first one. And what is quite beautiful, this has a similar function now. It's not only the 90th birthday, but it brings the Western Sangha in particular, but also quite a number of outstanding Thai senior monks, and it brings them all together. And I'm joyfully looking forward to that. It will be busy, there will be a very limited opportunity to talk. I arrive only after flying all around the world on a Friday morning. Quite a few monks leaving already Sunday evening. Most of them come about a day earlier than me. Most of them come Thursday. Some are there already coming now. So limited opportunity to talk, but even just being together, paying respects together, and doing the chanting together. There will be a party mokka on Wednesday. Apparently they expect to have more than 120 bhikkhus there, which is very outstanding for the West, and which will be more than the other big gatherings. I think we had about 100 in a previous international elder meeting. Now this would be even more. So I'm really looking forward to that, to have this strong Sangha experience. I mean, I value solitude. Dhammagiri has a strong appreciation of solitude, and we obviously don't have many monks here, hermitage. But when I go out, then it's actually quite nice not to have the other aspect, because there are these two aspects for Sangha life. And for most people nowadays, with our level of power, my personal impression is what I've seen over the last 30 years is actually not necessarily ideal for most Westerners, I can't speak better for Westerners, it's not ideal for them to be in extreme seclusion. It doesn't seem to give the best results. I believe if you have someone who has got the parami, the maturity of spiritual faculties, that they can realize full arahantship, full nibbana in this very life, this very high parami, then this may be the best one to support them to achieve that. Even then, with prior first training, but then going into intense solitude and only occasionally contact with a good teacher. But my feeling is, for our level of paramis nowadays, for most, a combination of solitude and interaction in the Sangha and also making punya and doing wholesome activity externally, supporting the sasana, all of that is a tremendous good karma and building up parami. And having a combination of this is the best. And Ajahn Chah was, I think, very wise, or at least very effective for our time and age, the way he set up the training system, very helpful for people who had maybe not quite such high parami. And the Ajahn Mun's system, which was basically, you hide out in the cave till you're an arahant. And before that, you don't even think of maybe starting a monastery or teaching or anything. It's great for those with this very, very high parami. Well, we have very few of those nowadays, not easy to find. So it's really good, and I'm looking forward to going there, experiencing that, having that contact. Another thing not that far from Parinibbana, which the Buddha taught, was the Appadihaniya Dhamma, the factors of non-decline for the Sangha, which is obviously important to sustain the Sangha long-term. And even if you think of those who have the high parami, that they prosper spiritually in terms of practice, they prosper most in almost complete solitude. In terms of the longevity of the Sangha, that will be difficult. Because you can't really establish a very strong, cohesive Sangha by just everyone living completely on their own. That doesn't really work. Human beings don't function like that. If you want to have a strong community, you also have to meet. And so even if it's sometimes maybe slowing down the progress a little bit of some monks or nuns, one also has to consider that in the end, if the sasana lasts much longer, because the Sangha is actually strong, cohesive, in harmony, in the end that means that actually still many more beings realize the Dhamma, because it lasts longer. And I'm sure when they're preparing now for Amaravati, they're probably not getting very good samadhi while they're working away and getting ready for that event. But it certainly contributes to the longevity of the Sangha, because the first of these factors for non-decline is that the Sangha should meet regularly, frequently. I think it's Abhinnang in Pali. Abhinnang, basically like always, it means always, really a lot. And then the second is that they are conducting the Sangha business that is required in harmony. And the third, that they then separate and disperse again in harmony. So there's already three times the concern with these meetings. It shows how important it is. And this is what we are doing there. And it's not easy to keep an international tradition together, particularly if you don't have a pope who can anathetize you and easily kick you out. And if you don't have a system like in the military where you get court-martialed if you don't obey, but ultimately it's a voluntary association. You can't force anyone. So you really have to feel that community. The people who are part of that community, you really have to feel that and must have the aspiration to maintain it and to be willing to do something to maintain it, or even sacrifice something to maintain it. And to generate that and maintain that, you need to meet. And even with Zoom and all the stuff we have nowadays in terms of internet communication, you cannot fully substitute, in my humble opinion, the real physical meetings with something different. So I'm also very happy that I'm participating in maintaining the first three factors of non-decline of the Sangha by coming together there. But of course it's also fun. It's meeting good friends. It's a good time as well. But and another one is to honor and respect and revere the bulls of the herd, the leaders of the herd, the real senior monks. And we are doing that as well. Because that is the 90th birthday, and Lumpa Samido was certainly one of the leaders. We just talked about, Ajahn Muneo mentioned the elephant. Elephant is a great danger nowadays. We have recently heard about quite a number, I think 4 or 5 monks, we heard recently, in the last half year or something, who died from elephant attacks in Thailand and in Sri Lanka. So they're quite dangerous. And Van Kuti, where Ajahn Muneo stayed, Bhante Sila told him all kinds of elephant stories, but it's more from the past. By now, I would have been very upset with that elephant anyhow. If he had done anything to you, he shouldn't dare. But we are talking, sometimes people try to run away into the bush when the elephant attacks, but this is not a good idea. Because as a human being, you get stuck there in the bush. Whereas the elephant, he can just plow through. It's just like a steamroller. They're so strong, big and heavy that they can run full speed into the bush and just plow through, so they're much faster. But not sure, maybe not the best simile or metaphor for Lumpa Samido, but it's a little bit like this path breaker. And when he started Wat Banana Chart, he founded that, that's still going. And already, I think 15 years ago, when I saw a list of Western monks ordained in Anachart already 15 years ago, and it was a very, very long list, very impressive. And then he founded Chithurst, and then he founded Amaravati. I mean, not on his own. The one thing why Ajahn Chah's attempts were more successful than other ones in establishing Sangha in the West is that he had that Sangha emphasis, and it was not only Lumpa Samido. Right from the beginning, they had 4 or 5 monks. Ajahn Chah would always make sure to send other monks or some of them going back to Thailand to not get burned out and so on. But he was a leader there. And the other monasteries never founded then explicitly in kind of as branches of that. I think Harnam would be a case like that, and Hartwich. So very impressive, like this big, powerful person who could just get into the forest and who had the power and the strength to open up that pathway. Pioneer, exactly. Pioneer. This may be a better simile than a charging elephant. But I mean, Naga in Pali, that elephant has quite powerful connotations. Exactly. No? So if I compare Lumpa Samido to a strong Tusker, Naga elephant, Tusker elephant, I think it's not inappropriate. But yeah, Aussie idiom, he is a pioneer. But the Aussie culture is that you usually wouldn't want to be praised. I remember Ajahn Aryasilo, and he was here, and because he was a real pioneer already in lay life. It was in the very early days of Bodhinyanamama and Bodhinyana Monastery and helping and living there as a layperson already. But when I called him a pioneer in public, he immediately, no, I'm not a pioneer. So as a culture, I'm just one of the boys. Like Steve Irving, when they tried to do a state funeral for him, and the parents says, "Oh, our son is just a normal Aussie bloke. He need no state funeral." Anyway, but I agree with you, and he's a true pioneer. And I'm very happy now that we can do that.
Uh-huh. He was ready, because before that he was doing Tudong, and then he was ready, his mother invited him, and then he established, and I think this is how it started.
For a podcast and YouTube, someone just points out, very appropriately on Mother's Day today, today's Mother's Day, someone points out very appropriately, that it was actually Ajahn Chah's mother who invited him to start that monastery. I may have read that, but I must admit, if you had asked me now, I think I wouldn't even be aware of that.
I've just read it, that's why I didn't
read exactly. And it's obviously very important, because without that, who knows what might have happened. He might have continued the wandering life. If we didn't have Wat Nongpa Phong, we wouldn't have all these disciples, we wouldn't have Nana Chart, we wouldn't have the Ajahn Chah tradition in the West. So big anumodana, mudita, and gratitude to Ajahn Chah's mother for inviting him. And as far as I'm aware, she later became a Meiji, a nun, lived in the monastery. And I remember that photo when Ajahn Chah counseled and guided his own mother in her dying moments to guide her to establish her Dhamma practice and mindfulness, and she died. Quite a beautiful photo.
And he agreed mostly out of gratitude that he wanted to help his mother to cultivate, because his mother was a pious woman.
Sadhu, sadhu, no, because what can you do when your mother asks? And that's something which is highly appropriate and wholesome and good. That is true, yeah. So, all dear mothers on Mother's Day, blessings and best wishes to you. But also use the leverage you have over sons, if you can do something really good and wholesome to get your sons to do something like that. Jana? Oh, just rejoicing. Great. The question of rejoicing. Good, good. Now, thanks so much for mentioning that. So now this is sometimes in the background, and this is not the first thing you get told when you hear of Lungpa Cha and you talk about that. And these things now are so powerful. This is why it's so powerful karma to start a monastery. Mm. The Buddha said, from all material gifts you can give, building a monastery for the Sangha of the Four Quarters is by far the highest. And you see the effects. And now what we are having there with Lungpa Sumedho, now that is next generation, and he is already 90 now. And then younger monks, now I never even met Ajahn Chah, or Ajahn Monei, or the majority now, never met him even. And still connected with that invitation the mother issued originally.
This Ajahn Mahapur was similar to the mother. And if you remember this mother, and then it was the motivation that he stays there, close to his home village, and starts a monastery.
Ajahn Monei, pointing out, was similar with Lungta Mahabua. That was also the mother originally inviting him. There's another monastery which actually also had quite a number of foreign disciples. And Ajahn Mahabua ended up being, from about the time when Lungpa Thet passed away in the 90s until he passed away, in the most outstanding representative of the forest tradition in Thailand, and in the end a very well-known celebrity, and spreading the Dhamma very widely, using his celebrity status to get people into contact with Dhamma. Yeah, and the mother. Sadhu, sadhu.
Yeah.
Yeah, is Venerable Panya, Panya Vudho, the first Western disciple of Lungta Mahabua, to my knowledge, yes. to my knowledge, yes, although I couldn't 100% say whether someone else had turned up there earlier, but it seems somewhat unlikely, because in the 1960s there were not that many around, and I've never heard, certainly the one in robes, the only one who was a longer-term disciple, the first, and probably the first at all, yeah. He was also invited, Lungta Mabur was also invited by the English Sangha Trust before Ajahn Chah. And he went, and Ajahn Panya also went and translated, but it didn't quite work out, and Lungta Mabur didn't quite feel that it is. And exactly, yeah, yeah. But maybe also the style of training of Ajahn Chah may have been maybe more suitable for Westerners. Yeah.
I also remember Ajahn Mabur said then, if any Westerners want to go there, they have to go there on their own responsibility, so he wouldn't send his disciples to start something, so he probably felt he wouldn't be ready or whatever, he wouldn't be the best person for for the task. And he himself, maybe as well, Ajahn Panya Vado, maybe as well.
Again, I think Lungta Mabur was more what I mentioned as an Ajahn Man training style. And there's roughly the idea, and first you become an Abahant, then you start thinking about teaching or monasteries. And of course, and if you do that in the West, then you don't have many monasteries. There's not so many Abahants around. You will be having an acute shortage. Whereas Ajahn Chah had a different approach, and even starting monasteries, he would kind of integrate that in his style of training, and he would try to encourage people and train people that even activities like that become part of their bhavana, part of their mental cultivation. So it seems it was just more set up for Ajahn Chah and his disciples. The other thing is that Ajahn Panya had already tried. He ordained first time in the 1950s with, I think, three other monks. Ne? Three or four ordained. And then they went back and tried to actually do what Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah later did and lived in England. But he got too exhausted. And before long, the other three were disrobed and married, and he was the only one still there. And no real Sangha coming up. He was just living in the Vihara as a local caretaker and teacher, and then even being sent around to different places teaching the Dhamma. And fortunately, he had enough parami and determination that he recognized he's burning out. And then he went to Thailand and started training with Lungta Mabur. And I think he took new ordination for the Dhamma Yud. So when he passed away, he would have actually had more veins if you count his first ordination. So maybe another one after Ajahn Panya had already been there and had experienced now as his fellow monks all ended up disrobing and himself having to pull the emergency brake and use the emergency exit and escaping to Thailand to preserve his own practice. Obviously, and then sending him again doesn't sound like the best idea. Yeah, I think the way it worked out is actually very good. Yeah, but it was by no means clear, and even Ajahn Chah didn't know exactly from what I hear and what would happen there. And he was willing to give it a try, but they were not really sure. It wasn't like, no, this is dead set, and we do that, and come what may. But then with this style and having Sangha there, it did work.